God calls us to wholeheartedly live for Him, to love people in the way that is truly centered on others. As we read 1 Corinthians 13, it's a love that bears all things, endures all things. Ladies, today on Gateway to Joy, Elizabeth Elliott shares another lesson in following the Master, the one who came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. Here's Elizabeth Elliott.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend Elizabeth Elliott talking with you today about standing up for Jesus. There may be some children listening to me today. It may come out that they are Christians. Some of the kids in school may find that out, and they think you're a very peculiar kind of a person. You homeschoolers, you are certainly thought to be peculiar, aren't you? And one of the things that our parents taught us is just to accept the fact that Christians are different. They're supposed to be different because we live in two different worlds. We live in a visible, tangible world, but we are living for the invisible and the intangible world. And we can't expect this world to understand us. We are indeed different. If your children come home and say, well, everybody's doing so-and-so, everybody has this, everybody goes to such-and-such, it's a very simple thing to just say, yes, that may be true, but we don't. We don't need this. We don't go there. Well, I said on Monday that we'd be discussing some very popular topics this week. I meant subjects which occupy a great deal of media attention, but subjects which should send us who love God to our knees. On Monday and Tuesday, I spoke about homosexuality, which may or may not have anything to do with genes, but which does involve a choice. The choice to pursue a homosexual lifestyle or not to. I have known some Christians who were homosexual in the sense of their orientation. And I have known some who never once indulged in sexual activity. God gave them the grace to be faithful to His word and to remain celibate and single. But now let's address another hideous evil in our country. I wrote a little leaflet several years ago called Person or Thing. It seems to me that this is the heart of the abortion issue. What is it exactly that is being removed from the mother's womb? Is it a person or is it a thing? Not long ago, Time magazine reported another triumph of modern medical technology. An unborn child found by means of a process called amniocentesis to suffer from Down syndrome was aborted, parenthesis, terminated, quietly done away with, killed, end of parenthesis. It was all very safe and scientific and sterile. Not only was there little danger to the mother, there was no harm to the other twin in the mother's womb. The affected child, is that an accepted word? Should I say afflicted, unwanted, undesirable, useless, disposable? The affected child was relieved of its life by being relieved of its life blood, which was slowly withdrawn through a long needle which pierced its beating heart. This was called a therapeutic abortion. The word therapeutic means serving to cure or heal. The strange part about this case was that nobody except the aborted child was ill. Who then was cured? Who was healed? It seemed a huge irony that only a few weeks later, the same magazine hailed another medical breakthrough, surgery to correct an abnormal kidney condition known as hydronephrosis. The amazing part about this case was that the patient was an unborn child, again, one of twins. Again, a needle was inserted through the mother's abdominal wall, through the uterus, through the amniotic sac lining, through the abdominal wall of the fetus, into the bladder. The needle was not used to withdraw blood, but to insert a catheter which would drain urine, thus saving little Michael's life. For all its promise, Time comments, fetal surgery poses some difficult ethical dilemmas. difficult indeed, but only if we refuse to call the thing operated on a child. In the first case, the mother did not want it. Whatever she called it, it had every possibility of becoming a person, and only as a person posed a threat. When it was rendered harmless, that is, when the heart no longer beat, when it was in fact dead, she continued to carry it to term. Then, along with its twin, it was born. Its twin had been very like itself to begin with, fully capable of becoming a person, but now very different indeed. Wanted, desirable, useful, and alive. In the second case, the mother wanted both the twins, the well one and the sick one with the swollen bladder and kidneys. To her, what was in her womb was her children. Could they possibly save the tiny thing? Was there anything they could do for her baby? It was, did the mother ever question it, a baby. Dr. Leonie Watson said, if they can do surgery on a fetus, then it is, in fact, a baby. We recognize how far we have departed from what nature has always told any prospective mother when we realize that arguments must be adduced, some of them even from technical procedures like fetal surgery, to prove that the living, moving creature about to come forth into the world is a human baby. If surgery is possible, then it's a baby. This is, of course, where the battle lines are drawn. Is it or is it not? What is the thing to be aborted? What is the thing to be born? What is the thing on which surgery was done? If we call it a fetus, does it make the ethical dilemmas less difficult? Dr. Philip Stubblefield, a gynecologist at Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital, argues that a fetus is only a baby if it can live outside the womb. If we can accept his assertion, may we also assume that a patient is not a person unless it can survive without, for example, dialysis or a heart pump? Is a machine somehow more humanizing than a womb? Is it possible seriously to believe that successful detachment from the mother is what turns an otherwise disposable and expendable mass of tissue into what we may legitimately call a baby? Katharine Hepburn sent out a letter, I suppose to nearly everybody, otherwise I don't know how I would have gotten on her list, appealing for $3.6 million to stand up against what she called repressive legislation to limit individual rights and productive freedom. She listed 8 reasons why a certain amendment which would prevent abortion on demand should be defeated. Not a single one of her 8 reasons would stand up in any court as a valid argument against the amendment if the thing aborted were called a person. That is the question. That is the only relevant question. When what Miss Hepburn calls individual rights and reproductive freedom impinge on the rights of a person other than the pregnant woman, that is, on a person who happens to be hidden, helpless, and at the mercy of the one entrusted with its life, are we who object hysterical, illogical, bigoted, fanatic? Are we duped by what she calls simple, outdated platitudes of television preachers if we cry aloud against her and her kind? Last week, there was another scandal. A woman had been running nursing homes, which turned out to be what an investigator called human sewers. She made a great deal of money off another group of defenseless human beings, the elderly, who had something in common with the fetuses Miss Hepburn claims the right to dispose of. They, too, were hidden, helpless, and at the mercy of the one entrusted with their lives. People were outraged. These victims had not been treated as human beings. Why all the fuss? Suppose we apply some of the arguments used in favor of abortion to the treatment of the indigent, the friendless, the senile. If there's brain damage or deformity, the fetus, read also the senile or the crippled, may be terminated. If the fetus is becoming a person, that is, being born, would be a serious inconvenience to the mother or to other members of the family, it may be terminated. As has often been observed, there's no such thing as a convenient time to have a baby. All babies, and many disabled or bedridden people, are an inconvenience. All are at times what might be called a serious inconvenience. Love alone endures all things. If a baby is allowed to be born, it may become the victim of brutality. One solution offered for the battered child syndrome is abortion. What about the neglected octogenarian syndrome? A 16-year-old high school student who has no prospect for a stable home and whose pregnancy will end her chance for an education is counseled to abort her baby. How should we counsel a 58-year-old divorced man about what to do with his invalid mother? Taking care of her might end his chances for a lot of things. If we refuse to allow medically safe abortions, we are told that we thereby encourage back-alley butchery, self-induced procedures of desperate women, even suicide. By the same token, if we outlaw sterile injections of, say, an overdose of morphine administered to an old man in a nursing home whose quality of life does not warrant continuation, do we thereby encourage less humane methods of getting people out of the way? What is this thing? We are faced with only one question. Are we talking about an object, or might it by any stretch of the imagination be a person? If we can't be sure of the answer, at least we can pick up a clue or two from the word of the Lord which came to Jeremiah. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you for my own. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you to be a prophet for the nations. To God, at least, Jeremiah was already a person. For my part, I will try to regard whatever bears the marks of humanity as God's property and not mine.
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliott, author of over 20 books, including Discipline, The Glad Surrender, and No Graven Image. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliott. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.